Hello, Damien Carrick here with part two of Inside the Jury Room, a special Law Report co-production with the University of Melbourne Law School. Now, I should warn, this program contains graphic descriptions of violence.
Do you stop every trial where the jury does something a little odd? What's the line you draw?
For various reasons, jurors might not be able to concentrate on evidence. It could be boring, it could be heartbreaking or violent.
You have people's lives in your hands, so you listen and you take your notes all day long and you're glued to every word that's said.
Everyone has an equal opportunity to do it. Everyone has to, you know, be available for it, so, you know.
I wouldn't want to be tried by a jury myself.
Just my turn.
Last episode, you heard the story of the two murder trials of Stephen Young in England back in 1994. It was the ultimate jury-gone-mad story. Young was charged with the double murder of Harry and Nicola Fuller. The prosecution case was strong and the jury returned a guilty verdict. But the conviction was quashed after a young juror named Adrian revealed to the News of the World that four drunken jurors in a hotel room had used a Ouija board to contact the victims and ask, "Who killed you?"
I just couldn't live with myself. To me, this was a miscarriage of justice. I thought to myself, this is someone's life we're dealing with. I was astonished that these grown-up people had played this child's game.
Young was put on trial for a second time, and once again he was found guilty. A few years later, a juror in this second trial, known as David, came forward, and he spoke to the BBC about a harrowing 999 call made by a wounded and desperate Nicola Fuller.
You heard the emergency operator say, "Can I help you?" And the woman who'd been shot was just garbling. And she was saying, "Help, I've been shot." But the woman at the other end was saying, "Look, if there's a problem, can you get your mummy?" Because it sounded like a young child, just garbling. And this was just too much. It was like your worst nightmare.
Nicola was shot a number of times, including through the cheek. Wounded, she made a distressed call to emergency services, who, because of her dreadful injuries, couldn't understand her. She was then fatally shot moments later. And as juror David told the BBC, he began to have actual nightmares in the weeks after the end of the trial.
And I said to my wife that I had a nightmare. She said, "Oh," she said, "you've had a nightmare." She said, "We've had a nightmare living with you." I said, "But I feel all right now." She said, "You might feel all right, but we're still suffering."
David's description of the personal impact of jury duty is a reminder that we should have enormous respect for all jurors, especially those who sit on difficult cases. And perhaps we should take a slightly softer line on the hapless drunken jurors who used a Ouija board and undermined the first trial.
It brings home that this would have been a very disturbing trial for them. 100 years ago, the evidence would have been put by witnesses describing things, and perhaps that would mediate some of the stresses of the trial. Now jurors spend more time than they used to, not listening to witnesses, but watching videos, looking at photos, listening to audio recordings. And so they're hearing and experiencing the evidence very directly.
That's Jeremy Gans, an expert in criminal law at the University of Melbourne Law School. He's author of The Ouija Board Jurors, Mystery, Mischief and Misery in the Jury Room. Today, we're looking at how exposure to harrowing evidence can sometimes cause a juror to experience stress. It's a prospect that worries many of the first-time jurors who are arriving at Melbourne's county court, ready for jury duty.
And the third reason you might need to apply to be excused is the nature of the charges. That a lot of the content that we're dealing with can be quite confronting. Some people might find it a little bit upsetting. And if you feel that, given what you have heard the judge explain to you, that you would not be able to make a fair and impartial decision?
Gruesome. That would be, yeah, the only thing I really wouldn't want. I don't want to have to remember the details of the case. Or anything involving children or anything like that. I don't really want to have to live with those pictures in my head.
Oh, I don't want anything involving, obviously, women, children, anything that would give me nightmares. It's never nice. Don't want to have to think about it afterwards, but it's all part and parcel of it, isn't it?
I mean, do you think of it as a civic duty?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone has an equal opportunity to do it. Everyone has to, you know, be available for it. So, you know, just my turn.
But while jury duty can be nerve-wracking, Professor Cheryl Thomas, the director of the Jury Project at the University College of London, says we need to be careful not to lose sight of the big picture. She's widely regarded as one of the world's leading jury researchers.
I think it's incredibly important not to overstate the extent to which jurors suffer from things like PTSD or even the extent to which they say they found serving on a jury upsetting. The reality is that the overwhelming majority of jurors in England and Wales, I have to say, come away saying that they found the experience interesting, educational, informative, and the overwhelming majority said they would be happy to do jury service again if they were summoned.
Indeed, you've done research on this very point, and I think you found that 81% said that they would do it again.
That's correct. I did research over a number of years involving over 1,000 jurors, different courts in England and Wales.
Mm. And I think there's also research...
Can I just say, David, that they said they would be happy to do jury service again if they were summoned, not just, yes, I would do it if I was summoned because you have to. But I think that's what's really relevant is they were very willing to do it again when they got to the end of their jury service. The reality is most people, when they're first summoned, are very reluctant and unhappy about the fact that they've been summoned for jury service. And the fact that when they have served on a jury and when they've completed their jury service, their view of that has changed so dramatically tells you that there's actually something incredibly positive that happens to people, the overwhelming majority of people, when they do jury service. So stories about jurors being, you know, suffering from PTSD or various other problems, they need to be considered seriously, they need to be addressed, but they are overwhelmingly the minority of people who do jury service.
Certainly, since the time of the Ouija board trial, courts around the world have lifted their game, and many now provide counselling for jurors who find the experience a difficult one. In the 1990s, courts were only just beginning to understand the stress that juries could experience.
Yeah, it turns out just around 1994 was a bit of a tipping point where some very high-profile, terrible trials had happened, where everyone recognised that the jurors were going to need some counselling.
It's one of the most talked-about crimes in Canadian history. Two savage murders, a young, nice-looking husband and wife accused in the killings, and more twists and turns than anyone could have imagined.
Rosemary West, on trial at Winchester, accused of 10 murders, today became the first witness called in her own defense.
Police won't confirm a newspaper report that Dahmer has confessed to murder and cannibalism.
The suspect may well have been involved in at least 17 homicides.
So in Canada, there was the Bernardo trial, a terrible serial killer trial. There was the O.J. Simpson trial the following year, which was not so much disturbing in its content, but such incredibly high profile that everyone accepted the jury would need some help coping with the public eye on them. In the UK, there was the Rosemary West House of Horrors trial. And again, the jurors in that case were offered counselling. So there was a realisation around this time, a little too late really for the Stephen Young jurors, that jurors are going to need some help in some trials.
There was also the Jeffrey Dahmer serial killer in the US.
So that year there was the Dahmer case, another serial killing and rape case, and the jury in that case were offered help. Nevertheless, those were all spectacularly awful, high-profile, evil mass killings of the sort where anyone could see that jurors would be stressed. The Fuller case, where Harry and Nicola were killed, was awful, but it wasn't all that different to many other trials. What was particularly awful about this case was that one piece of evidence about the 999 call. And at least at that point, it hadn't been recognised that just a particular piece of evidence might be something jurors need help with.
Jennifer Penn made a 911 call and said there was a home invasion and she heard gunshots in the basement of their house.
That's Patrick Fleming speaking from Ontario. Back in 2014, he was a juror on a trial that lasted 10 long months. He's talking about a particularly horrific piece of evidence.
As the 911 call was taking place, in the background, all of a sudden you could hear just a horrific scream. And Jennifer was like, "Oh, I think that's my dad." And you could just hear in the background just a terrible scream. It was just chilling, the sound of it.
Jennifer Pan had tried to disguise her part in the murder plot to kill her parents by calling 911 and pretending the family were victims of a random home invasion.
It took your breath away. It was so chilling. It was just terrible, the sound of that screech.
And this was the father who had recovered consciousness after being shot and waking up to find his wife dead next to him.
That is correct. He woke up in the basement with a bullet hole in the front of his face, and his wife was shot three times, and the fatal shot was in the back of the head. And when he woke up, she was on his feet. He jumped up and he ran up the stairs and out the front door.
Jennifer Pan and her co-accused were found guilty of murder and attempted murder. The 911 call featured prominently in the trial.
They do seem to play disturbing evidence to jurors as well as photos. I think it's part of the way that they get us shaken up. I think that would be it.
And Patrick Fleming, what impact did that have? What impact did that evidence have on you?
As you know, we can't share any of the information. So what ends up happening is when you come home from a day of gruesome pictures, photos, and testimonies, you can't share that, and it's disturbing. So you pull yourself away from the people you love, and you end up really just isolating yourself. So it has a huge impact on not just you as a juror, but the family and friends that love you and that you love.
Can I ask, you've spoken about the impact on you. What impact did this have on your family?
They lost me for 10 months and beyond. I couldn't support them as I normally would. So the isolation and pulling away from your family, you're not there for them.
Ontario juror Patrick Fleming. Back in 2014, there were no counselling services available for jurors in that province. Patrick Fleming is one of 37 witnesses to appear before the Justice Committee of the Canadian Parliament. It's been holding an inquiry into counselling and other mental health supports for jurors. You're listening to Inside the Jury Room, a special series on RN's Law Report. It's available online on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Tina Danza was a juror in the 1995 trial of serial murderer Paul Bernardo. Like Patrick Fleming, she appeared as a witness before the Canadian Parliament's Justice Committee.
Well, there was a lot of evidence, of course, but mainly there was a lot of videotape evidence because he had taped the assaults, rapes of the young women. He did not tape the murders themselves, but he taped the rape and assaults of the young girls.
And those videos were crucial evidence for the prosecution.
Yeah, you know, because the hard thing is when, you know, you're sitting in that courtroom, you're very much like you're in a fishbowl, right? So we had monitors right inside the jury box in front of us. But you cannot look away and you can't close your eyes because the entire courtroom is watching you. And I don't even know how to explain it, because if you look away or you close your eyes, somebody's going to say, well, they weren't paying attention to the evidence, right? It was this feeling of being trapped in this box. You almost had that anxiety of fight or flight. Like, how do you deal with that, you know?
How many times did you have to watch the videos?
That was the problem. Over and over and over and over again, because there wasn't just one. There was a whole whack of them, and they kept playing them over and over and pointing out this and pointing out that. And it wasn't like you had to watch it once and then you go, okay, ooh, that was really bad. But you just had to, you know, keep watching it at night when I went home, the videos would replay in my head and I couldn't get rid of them. I was just in a fog. I would go home and my husband would just kind of put me on the sofa and cover me up with a blanket and make me a cup of tea.
So you were unable to relate to your spouse. You were unable to look after your own kids, to relate to your own kids.
Oh, barely. Like, I mean, I think I'm not sure. I can't remember. Did I cook? Or he took care of mostly everything. And definitely, you know, intimacy between my husband and I was non-existent for a very, very long time, even months and months after the trial, because it was just so horrific watching those videos.
Did you have any physical symptoms?
Yes, they actually, one day in court, the judge had to call a recess because I was having heart palpitations. I thought I was having a heart attack, and he called a recess, and I called my doctor and explained what was going on. And she said, you know, you're having an anxiety attack, right? Because it was just, it was so overwhelming. It did only happen once, but yes, definitely.
I understand that the judge, Patrick Lesage, recognized that this was an especially traumatic trial, and he made counselors available to you at the end of the trial. Did you use the counseling service after the trial was over?
Definitely. I felt I needed it. I was actually diagnosed with PTSD, and you went for numerous counseling sessions and was advised that we were welcome to use the service for as long as we felt necessary.
How long did you use the service for?
I think I went 4 or 5 times. Each one is probably about an hour long.
And how important was that counselling for you in terms of moving on from this experience?
It really helped a lot and helped me find a way to get back to my real life, to my husband and my children.
Tina Dainzer talking there about the value of counselling in enabling her to get back to her husband and her children, back to her normal life. It was only in 2017 that it became standard practice in Ontario to offer counselling to all jurors rather than rely on an individual judge to make it available. That reform was due to the advocacy of Mark Farrant.
Certainly when you're in the courtroom and you're a juror, you're absorbing it. So, you know, you go home at the end of the day and some of those images really sit with you.
In 2014, Mark Farrant was the jury foreman in the 4-month trial of Farshad Badakhsham, who was charged with murdering his girlfriend, Karina Patrash. Badakhsham stabbed his victim multiple times and then set her on fire.
You come in the next day and they're right back at you again. You know, you come in immediately and poof, the autopsy photo is back up on the screen, really precisely where you left off the day before.
The defence put to the court that Badakhsham had a history of mental illness, while the prosecution argued that he was exaggerating his illness.
He was silent, obviously. He never took the stand. We never heard from him. But he certainly enjoyed every day staring at members of the panel. And he would transfix himself on you and would try and make eye contact with you. And, you know, I would have those days where, you know, we would be back in the jury room afterwards and we'd say, you know, was he staring at you today? And you'd say, yep, today was mine.
After a 4-month trial, the jury found Farshad Badakhsham guilty of second degree murder. But it didn't end there for Mark.
I certainly was losing more and more sleep during the trial, which again, I just chalked up to being, it just being the stress of the commitment and the stress of the experience. But certainly after the trial was over, those emotions and those feelings just didn't go away. In fact, they just sort of accelerated. I had a lot of anxiety. I slowly removed myself from friends and family. I just cut myself off from people. I just felt like I was slipping further and further away.
I believe you became hypervigilant, and at one point you even put a knife in your jacket when you were taking your kid to the local park. So you became very, very frightened of the world.
Yeah, I was. I was. You know, I just, every time I would look at my daughter, I would, this image of her on a slab would, you know, on a coroner's table would come roaring into my head, and I couldn't dislodge it. So I wouldn't let her out of my sight. My daughter, I would hold her, you know, it was like a firm grip on her hand wherever we went in public. I wouldn't let people look at her or talk to her. And then, as you said, I just started to do strange, unusual things. And one of them was, you know, it felt very normal for me to just pick up my keys and put a pocket knife in my jacket, like it was, you know, a routine. One day my daughter asked me, you know, "Daddy, what are you doing? why are you putting a knife in your pocket?" I sort of looked at her and I had no explanation. So I knew there was a problem. I just didn't quite know how to address it.
Knowing he needed help, Mark Farrant and his family called the courts, who politely told them they had nothing to offer. Mark eventually found a clinic that specialises in PTSD, where he continues to receive treatment. Mark is now suing authorities for $100,000 Canadian, the cost of both past and future treatment. But for jurors who follow in Mark's footsteps, his advocacy has made a huge difference. As of 2017, Ontario now provides up to 8 hours of free counselling to all jurors. Mark Farrant, together with Patrick Fleming and Tina Danza, are now asking the Canadian Parliament's Justice Committee to recommend that courts right across Canada offer a similar service. One of the witnesses to appear before the committee is Paul Dore, the Victorian Juries Commissioner. Now, coincidentally, he's a Canadian by birth. I met Paul at the Jurors Lounge at the County Court in Melbourne. Paul Dore, we're in the jury lounge here in the County Court. I've just been hearing, I think, Kylie give an orientation to the jurors. It looks like there are about 80 or 100 people here today.
Yeah, we're expecting 90 people, and we're expecting 4 jury trials to start today. So 90 people will cover off those 4 trials.
I've come to the court to ask Paul Dore what support is offered to Victorian jurors who feel they need help after sitting through a traumatic trial.
We have had a juror support program in Victoria since, as far as I can see, since at least 2004, maybe a year or two earlier than that. We have recently made that response or that service far more robust. So we have got a juror support program that is equal to our employee assistance program. So the coverage and the access to that support system, qualified psychologist, is available to jurors as it is to employees. It's up to the juror whether they want to access that service. So it's not mandatory. It does not have to be judge directed. So it's, we promote it widely, and it's up to the juror as to whether they want to access that service by phone, in person, Skype, any way they want, and it doesn't matter where the juror is serving.
And what, that support is a series of counselling sessions? I mean, is it a finite number?
No. The arrangement we have with the provider is that the juror can use 4 sessions, 4 hours of counselling. So that's sort of the benchmark. But if the counsellor deems it necessary for the juror to continue, I just ask for a courtesy email that says, look, we've got a juror who might go 5 or 6 or 7 sessions. And that's just for accounting purposes. That's just so I'm not surprised when the bill comes in.
Tell me how many Victorian jurors over the last couple of years have accessed these services?
In 2016, we had 17 jurors access the program, 9 of them in person and 8 of them were over the telephone. In 2017, we had 8. Both those numbers are remarkably low, I think, given that we had 6,500 people serve on a jury.
Do you have information about why they accessed the counselling service?
In very general terms, and this is from our counsellors themselves, over that period, those 25 people, 8 of them were broadly diagnosed as suffering some sort of trauma. 13 of them had some personal stress and 4 of them had anxiety.
So this counselling, it's only available to jurors once the trial's over, once they've sat through the evidence, once they've sat round this jury deliberation table, reached a verdict and gone back into the courtroom and delivered it before the open court.
Yes, that's correct.
We tried to find out what services exist across Australia's states and territories. We understand that most jurisdictions offer some counselling. The ACT even offers counselling during trials, not only once a trial is over. Most states we called couldn't give us details of how many jurors accessed these services or how many counselling sessions each juror received. But it's a very different state of affairs to Canada, where some provinces offer no counselling, others only when a judge feels there is a need, and others, like Ontario, where it is now available as a right. And jurors like Patrick Fleming want the Canadian Parliamentary Inquiry to address this lack of consistency. What's amazing is that despite his traumatic experience, Patrick Fleming still firmly believes trial by jury is the best system.
All I'm asking for our government to do is stand behind us with this. We're not trained to do this, and that's all we really want is support and safety.
But there are no easy solutions. Fellow activist Mark Farrant acknowledges that simply being part of the justice system and trying to do the right thing is in itself inherently difficult.
It's the guilt. And sometimes in cases where there's a mistrial or a not guilty verdict, especially when you're in a courtroom and you're hearing the cries of the victim's family and the cries of relations calling out for justice. And so in those cases, the facts didn't ladder to a conviction. And that's delivering justice, right? That is our justice system. So justice was delivered that day. It's just a not guilty verdict. Or in some cases, the jury couldn't reach a verdict. And they might be at it for weeks. And they come back and say, you know, we are unable to reach a verdict. And so it's a mistrial. So jurors have felt incredible pain as a result of that.
Canadian juror Mark Farrant. Next time on Inside the Jury Room, we look closely at what happens when jurors have different attitudes, different mindsets, and different approaches to their duty. Inside the Jury Room is a co-production between The Law Report and the University of Melbourne Law School. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time.